This is part two of the interview with Brett Tanner.
The inbound calls that you're getting, I assume that they're higher quality since they're calling you and you don't have to touch base with as many in order to generate a listing or a sale. Is that true?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if they're calling us and our marketing message is in tune with what we're trying to do, it's tracking with the consumer, you know, obviously those calls are, I mean, they even laugh upstairs. They say those are laydowns. They're so easy to do. So yeah, it's definitely way easier. It's just your cost to acquire that customer is much greater than an outbound call. Our goal right now with a short sale listing would be for our goal is to acquire the customer in marketing expense for $500 or less. So if we can pay $500, our marketing campaign works to where every time we spend $500, we get a signed listing. Then we look to go out, how many times can we do that? I mean, we'll do as many times as we can.
What percentage of the inbound calls end up listing?
I would say on inbound calls, you're probably more at that 50% of the calls. I mean, it's a high number, maybe 40. It's high just because it's so, our message is so clear at this point that when someone picks up the phone and calls, at usually that point, they're just saying, hey, I'm ready to list my house.
You've mentioned the message and you keep tinkering with that message, molding it. What message is working right now?
For short sales, we focus on the incentives that they can get, whether through like the HAFA program, which is $3,000. In Arizona, there's a government-backed program that allows the homeowner to get up to $4,500 at closing to cooperate with the short sale. And they have to meet some criteria. So we promote that basically, you know, if you're interested in short selling your home, you can get up to $4,500, you know, to participate in that process. So that's the message we take out to the marketplace.
How are you putting that message out in the market?
So either via, you know, like direct mail, we craft a letter that, you know, explains that, you know, get up to $4,500 a short sale. Our billboard, we have a billboard up that all is get $4,500 a short sale. That's all it says with a phone number.
Short message.
Yeah, we found in billboard marketing, you really have to get your message across in five words or less, which is tricky, right? We started with our messages were much longer, and every time we cut it down, we did better. So eventually I was like, what's the least amount of words we can use? So now it's just the least amount of words possible. That's the goal.
So you just have get 4,500 per short sale and the phone number.
Yep, that's it. We tried driving people to the web. Yeah, we tried that. For us, you can drive people to the web, then they may fill out a form. Well, at that point, they may not put their correct phone number in. So you even reduce the amount of phone numbers you get. Where anyone that calls our billboard with our phone number, we instantly have their phone number so we can follow up.
You've mentioned that. Your whole objective is to get that phone number.
Yeah, and capture it and then route it to the sales force. I mean, that's our whole, whether, and we do that on the buyer side of the business, like on our signs. You know, you'd see two numbers on there, both are call captured. I mean, everything for us is about capturing the data.
This billboard, you have one or two? How many billboards do you have?
I think 11 today. And the reason I say I think is because I just signed a new contract. What we did is we started with digital billboards. The reason we did that is our ability to change messages and continually change a message. I mean, you could change a message five times a day on a digital billboard. So we could get something that would work and make the phone to ring. So when we started that process, we crafted about 10 different advertising messages, all with different tracking that we were throwing up on the billboards, on the digital boards. Well, within about a week, it was obvious which two to three ads performed way better. We then took those two or three ads, tweaked them again, tried to do better and better, and pretty quick we refined it down to the one board that worked. Once we proved the model, then we went to static boards in residential and other areas. But kind of the proving ground is the digital.
These billboards, where are they located?
The digitals are all on the freeways. Yeah, they're on major freeways. Some of the things we learned are the greater the traffic, you know, certain areas along the freeway have a greater propensity for traffic. So and through my negotiations and the rounds of billboards we've had, I've learned that the greater the traffic in drive time at any given location, the greater the board will perform. Because if they're sitting there in gridlock for 20 minutes, just sitting there, The board digital, though, you only get 10 seconds of every minute is yours. The rest of it's different advertisers. So they're sitting there for 15 minutes. They're going to see your board just splash in front of them, you know, 20 times. If that person's interested, they're probably going to call. That has been, you know, helpful.
What is your cost to put these billboards out there?
You know, our budget today for billboards is about $10,000 a month. So it's something you definitely have got to get results relatively quickly. So it's very pricey, and I think that's why you don't see, you know, a ton of agents do it.
And that's $10,000 a month for 11 boards, or about $1,000 each. Is that correct?
Yeah, it doesn't work out exactly that way. You know, you pay way more for boards in great locations and then way less for ones in not as high traffic locations. But, you know, on average, it averages out to that. But if you were to look at the cost for each board, it wouldn't shake out that way. Obviously, the ones on the freeways are much more expensive. You know, it's all based on eyeballs, you know, how many eyeballs see that board in a given day.
You're tracking the response on each individual billboard with an individual phone number to call?
Correct. Every board's got its own number.
You mentioned you have over 100 phone numbers. How does that work? You have 100 phone numbers. Are they, and how are you tracking? Are these local phone numbers? Are they 800 numbers? How did you set up this huge pool of phone numbers?
So there's services. There's two services online I found that do it. We use both. One is CallFire, CallFire, and the other one's Call8, KALL8.com. Both those services will sell you either local or 800 phone numbers. So we use both depending on, like on our digital billboard campaign today, we want to show a local presence, so we use local numbers. On some of our mailings, we wanted to maybe throw out a bigger company presence, so we'd use an 800 number. But all those numbers you can get on there, all you do is you take that number and you can point the number anywhere. So they're calling in, I can ring that number to a Google number that rings the entire sales floor. I can point it to just one specific salesperson's cell phone. I can point it to any number I want, but the magic is just in the minute they call, it captures the phone number, it instantly records the call, and then when the call's over, it emails me and whoever the salesperson is going to, I recorded the recording of that call, it emails them as well. So when I go into pull tracking, like right now I could with five clicks pull up, you know, one of our billboards or one of our mailings, I could see all the calls in the last whatever time frame I specified. I could see the length of the calls, listen to the calls, and pretty much get everything I would need to determine if it worked or not within minutes.
Are you able to capture the phone number even with the local phone numbers?
Oh yeah, local or 800 instantly. So even if they call in and they hang up, we still get an email with their phone number.
Does it capture the private phone numbers?
Yep. Unless they're, yeah, there's no way to block it. I've never seen one come through blocked.
I knew that about 800, but I didn't know about your local phone numbers. So they've designed it, the local number that they call, that it will also capture the private phone numbers?
It does. I have never seen one come through. It's a great question. I've never seen one come through private. So, and I'm sure we've had calls from people that have the number that's private.
Just approximately, how much is that costing you to have one of these magic phone numbers each month or each year?
It is very inexpensive for all of mine. And I told you I've got, you know, roughly 100, and then you're charged so much per minute. Like my monthly charge is about $150 a month. And that's for, I don't know, thousands of minutes. So it's very, very inexpensive. I mean, it literally is the only way to determine what you're spending and what you're making.
Wow. And that is really inexpensive for so many numbers. So like $1.50 on average per number. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's very, very inexpensive.
Is there anything else you could tell us about generating short sale leads?
I would say, I mean, whatever you're doing, if you're going to go out and spend, you know, obviously, if you don't have a marketing budget in place, I didn't in the beginning. To me, you either got to go ahead and get face to face with people, or you got to pound the phones. When you get to the point where you have even a small marketing budget, if it's $1,000 a month, I would invest it with an expectation of investing $1,000 a month to get two listings, and you have to be able to track it and measure and know, hey, I spent $1,000 this month and I got three listings. Next month I got two. And if you did that over time, then you should grow that number. But I would say the biggest thing is knowing what you're spending and what you're getting. If you do that, you can grow it to any scale. Like our beginning mailings, I mean, we were mailing, say, a couple thousand pieces of mail for $1,500. You know, it wasn't a lot. And once we got a mailing to work, then I would grow it. Then I would start mailing, you know, 4,000 pieces of mail, then 8,000, then 16, you know, because the numbers are pretty consistent. Once you prove it, if you mail 2,000 pieces and get two listings, and you mail the same mailing to the same type of data and you mail 4,000 pieces, you're probably going to get four listings. I mean, you're going to double it. And so if you can keep doubling the data, if there's enough people, you can keep doubling the result. And then the next thing will be if you're doing mail, or how often can you hit the same audience and get the same result? And so, I mean, it's just tracking numbers. If you can know your numbers and know exactly what you spent equals what return, you know, you can definitely continually grow your business and make it bigger and bigger.
How many direct mail pieces are you sending out now each month?
Recently, we haven't done a mailing in a little bit. I mean, last year, I probably throughout the year averaged 20,000 pieces a month. This year, we haven't. I mean, we've done some mailings. It's been pretty small. I'm working on some campaigns right now. I've been so focused on these billboards right now that I've kind of taken my eye off the mailings. And we're still getting such results that I haven't done it. But I'm crafting a couple new in our market. One of the reasons I quit in the mail is because our market changed so much and I needed to get a new message out there. So I just need to spend a little bit of time and craft our new piece and then get that out there.
You did mention you're trying to get these listings down to $500 per listing in marketing budget. Have you achieved that with the billboards? Are you getting 20 listings per month out of those billboards?
We are very close. The only reason we're not is in the beginning, we weren't running this consistent message. We were testing so much. But I would say, and there's also a lag with short sale prospects, unlike traditional, meaning if we get 20 calls today, we may get, you know, 10 listings today, but next month we'll still get one or two, and the following month we'll get one. I mean, there's kind of a long tail to it. So I would say we will be able to be at $500 with the long tail. We're right over that now. So we're a little over it. We're not, the only thing that's helped me in my marketplace is prices. The average sales price has pushed up so much, like over what it was last year, that it's allowed me to pay a little more to acquire the customer. And so that $500, I guess, to help people, to give them an idea of what percentage of the final sales price you want to look at, because that might be valuable. That was based on about 12%, I would say, of my sales price last year.
So 12% of the commission, the gross commission that you pull in.
The gross commission. Our average commission was, you know, $3,000 to $4,000. I plugged in 4,000 in my calculator when I just did it. But, you know, if you invested, so if you're in a higher sales price, you could, if you invested 12.5% and were able to mark and acquire a customer, you'd be very profitable at that. You'd prefer it to be 6%, obviously. You'd prefer it to be less. But, I mean, you can be profitable at that number.
On the short sales, how are you getting them closed? Are they difficult to get closed now, or is the process been smoothed out?
The process is very much smoothed out. The team member that was started actually is my personal assistant. We're going back 4 years ago. Today is our operations manager. She really runs, essentially, in large, if I'm not here, she's definitely running the business. But her main task is the whole short sale negotiation piece. She's got an assistant for her, as well as we have a virtual assistant. And so she really runs that whole piece. In our business, I really separate the sales process from the back end admin process. We are blessed in that we really have the best admin team put together. I mean, our admin staff is just incredible. So once sales, whether it's a buyer's agent or a listing agent, as soon as they get an agreement signed by the seller or the buyer, they turn that into admin, and then admin takes over. So all our sales force is doing is selling. They don't do paperwork. I found that salespeople are not great at paperwork as a group, and the less paperwork you have them do, the more they will sell. So we've reduced it, like in our state, it's a 3-page listing agreement. My listing agents know, even on a short sale, there's all of that documentation that's got to be collected. I don't care about any of it on the listing side. I want them to sign a 3-page listing agreement, and admin will collect the paperwork.
So you have someone on the admin side that's tracking the short sale from the time it gets listed all the way through when it gets closed?
Correct. She managed it. We use Short Sale Commander for that. I would say it's not a great software. It's just what we've had for so long. It's good. If you don't have anything, it's very good. But yeah, any more, the banks have gotten very systematic. You know, a lot of the banks are going to Equator. So we carry, like I looked just the other day, we've got about 80-ish short sales right now. that we're carrying. And with her and one assistant, she manages all that. Now, granted, she's one of the most talented admin I've ever seen, so that's definitely on the higher side of the scale.
Who negotiates the offer on the short sale when it comes in?
She does. So essentially, once that listing agreement is turned into her, she's responsible for getting it into the MLS, quality assuring the listing, receiving offers from agents, presenting those to the seller, getting those accepted or negotiated, presenting to the bank, managing the buyer, and she takes it all the way to closing to the point where we get a check back in our office.
She and one other person are able to handle 80 listings at a time. I assume that was not true when you started doing these short sales back in, what was it, 2006?
2008. No, it was not true at all. I mean, you definitely needed, probably one person back then could only handle 25 to maybe 40, just because of the process. There weren't systems on the bank side. A lot of it was our process wasn't good, but it was more the bank. I mean, there was no process at all. It was basically all art. I mean, every time it was different, so you had to kind of just interpret each situation, where today it's more science. I mean, they're, you know, banks have great processes, great procedure, great response times. You can escalate if you need to. So things go much, much quicker. So it doesn't require as much labor per file as it did. I mean, they're still very labor intensive, but not as much as it did.
Today, how long is it taking in number of days on average when you get a contract to when you can actually close a short sale?
I would say the average through all banks, we're probably closing, if we got a contract today, you know, we'd probably take 45 days maybe on average for an approval. And so you'd close in 75. So you're a little over 2 months, I would say, just because, and then, unless it's cash or something like that. But normally it's about 45 for an approval and then 30 days to close the loan.
What percentage of your short sales that go under contract are closing?
Boy, that's been such a moving target. You know, again, going back in time, it was so much lower. Today, we're over 80%.
Banks have really helped out there.
Oh, they've just gotten so much better, so much easier to work with. One of the keys on that, I want to take a step back, is we've gotten also better on what we take in. So we don't take every listing today. I mean, there are certain lenders we won't take. You know, if a client calls us and they've got a certain set of lenders, we would pass on that. We would say, you know what, we're probably not the right team to help you with that. You know, we could refer you to someone else. You could reach out to them. We're just not interested in every, because we found that certain deals, if we looked at our average closing rate, or that was what was pulling our rate down to where we weren't closing as many. So certain files we just won't take. You know, the most money you can make in short sales is off what you don't take, not off what you do take.
Do you take short sales where there are two loans on them?
We will. Again, there's a couple combinations we won't. There's just a couple lenders who I won't name, but if you've done any short sale, you could Google online who are bad lenders, and they'll be the ones that come instantly up. We just wouldn't take those. But so we'll take lenders. In my marketplace, we have to manage the sales price a little bit. I mean, if I would say anything with two loans that's under $100,000, we can't take it. I mean, you just can't make it. You can't be profitable by doing that in my system. And now that's without the agent working in it. You know, because I know if I give a talk here locally, some agent will always come up and say, well, I can make money doing it. I'm like, but yeah, but you're hanging the lockbox. You're negotiating your file. You know, you're a one-person show. Well, you could take anything and be profitable because it's just your time. But the instant you employ people to do it for you and you're managing through a process, if you take those same files, you won't be able to make, you'll be out of business.
Let's move from short sales to another quadrant of your business, the buyers. What are you doing with buyers? How are you developing that business?
If you looked at our real estate sign today, there's an amazing product that's come out in the real estate sign space. It's called Buyer Acquire, and it's almost available, I think, in every part of the country. What it does is it syncs to your MLS, where the phone number you call on the sign, when you call in, like whatever, our local number or our 800 number, both of ours go to the same place, and you call in on 351, say Johnson Street, but you call the phone number, it'll say, please enter the house number. So you hit 351, it pulls the information from the MLS and reads them off the information. So the minute they hit 351, say, thanks for calling 351 Johnson Street, this is a 3-bedroom, blah, 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 gives them all the information about the home. It says, if you want to speak to an agent, press 0. Some people do, some people don't. That's not what I'm after. But instantly when they call, we get an email, again, routed into our CRM that's pushed right out to an agent who's available to take a lead, and it says, we've got a lead, and so they call them right then. So we call them back and say, hey, you just called in on whatever, 351 Johnson Street. That product, you know, it used to be the old telephone tree that you had to spend your whole day recording the different messages, and if the sign got on the wrong house, you know, you're recording on the wrong, it was just a disaster. And this product is so inexpensive, it's like free. My lender pays for it, but I think it's like $30 a month. I mean, it's something ludicrously cheap. And with our amount of signs, we carry about 130 listings. You know, you're going to get, I don't know, 600 to 800 sign calls a month. And so we capture, again, all those and route those to our sales force. And to me, that's the key. One of the, I'll tell you a funny story about, you know, Russell Shaw. I got in the business and we got a bunch of listings. And I called him one day. I said, how do I get more leads out of these listings for our buyers? And he goes, great question. How many do you have now? I said, I have no idea how many I have now. I just know I need more. And so he said, well, how will you know if you get more if you don't know what you have? And I said, okay, you got me. And he goes, you got to go figure out how to track it. So I was like, all right, you know, thanks for the help. It's always, it's usually like when I talk to him, it's a little frustrating in the beginning and then you're grateful later. So I go back and I figured out, how can we figure out how many calls we got? So originally I had it going to like a receptionist who's making like ticks on a sheet of paper. Well, that doesn't work. And then we tried routing them to an agent, you know, like the round robin cell phone thing that I think every agent's done. The problem that none of those solve is if someone calls in and hangs up, the call's lost forever. So I had no idea how many people were calling in on signs and hanging up because someone didn't answer quick enough, or, you know, that you put them on hold, you're going to have somebody call them back. And the answer is, if your business is big enough, it's hundreds of calls per month. So once I put this system in place, I was literally blown away with how many calls we were getting that we were getting a chance to sell to. So we do very, very little in terms of marketing dollars spent on the buyer side of the business. We invest all of that budget in getting more listings, which feeds the sign calls.
You're generating this 600 to 800 sign calls per month. What percentage of those calls are turning into closings?
So we sold 250-ish buyers last year. So it's not a huge percentage, but part of that is due to my team in the past, and we're getting better at this. This is something we're working on. We're great at getting people that have a need today to buy a home. Like if they're buying in the next 30, 60 to 90 days, we're all over it. The guy that's 6-8 months out, we were a little weak on the follow-up system to stay in touch with him for that long of a period of time. We're since working to automate some of our CRM processes to do that for our agents. But I would say that, so if we close 250, the percentage is very, very low. I mean, the conversion rate's very, very low. But I don't think that's true because I think that's more our fault, not, you know, the quality of the lead. And in my experience, the greatest lead or the best lead in the real estate business is a sign call for a buyer. There's nobody, I've never found a human being out there that's driving around calling on real estate signs that wasn't interested in buying a home. Right? They're not going, oh, I wonder if I could just get like 15 agents to just call me a lot. Right? Let's play that game. No, they really, I mean, it's someone they're either buying or they're selling, right? They're calling because they want to get the price because they're selling a home four doors down. So we really work those leads over in a very, very big way.
Sounds like, if I ran some quick numbers, sounds like you're getting about 1 in 30, about 3% are converting at the end. So from how many calls you get in to how many actually turn in the contract. Tell us a little more about that process you're trying to put in place to convert more people.
We've always had, obviously, a CRM for each individual team member has their own CRM. We're looking to try to, from a team basis, what can we do to help them communicate more with those folks? One of the things is going to be video from maybe them, most likely me, you know, video via email out to that consumer. We're going to leverage some call technology to where I could call and leave. It'll seem like a personalized message, but it's going to be the same message going to 5,000 people. And then we're looking at texting, a way to text out to stay in contact with people. The new data that shows texting, you know, they're saying only a certain percentage of emails are read, but you know, texts, there's such a high percentage of texts that are read, you know, we're starting to look into that technology, because we've got everyone's, obviously, that when they call in on the sign, it's a cell phone number. So we're looking at how can we better leverage the cell phone numbers that we have.
That sounds like that's still in development.
That is very much in development. I mean, we're getting closer. You know, I've got, again, today we have so many projects going on, and I'm kind of an idea guy, so you got to refine it down to what are we focusing on and what are our core projects we're going to work on and get completed and then keep moving forward.
Let's talk about the last quadrant of your business. That's the REO business. You said you came to that party late. How did you get in?
The way I got in is I leveraged some relationships that I already had. I'd helped a lot of agents with either our documentation or some training on the short sale side of things. And so when I went to get an REO, I started talking to some agents. Hey, who do you know? Could I go with you to a conference? Could you introduce me to so-and-so? And it was actually through other agents that I was able to at least get an introduction to someone who could potentially give me business. And also some of our other partners, like our title company here locally, was very, very much involved in that space. And was the joke that they made is, we can't get you REO business, but we could get you in the room where REO business is taking place. And then what you do inside the room, that'll determine whether or not you get it. So I was able to get some introductions, and then it goes back to hammering the phones. I mean, if I got someone's name that I thought could give me an asset, I mean, I will call them forever. One asset manager, I called them and said, are you guys taking new applications? They said, no, we're full on agents. I called her the next day and said, hey, are you guys taking applications? She said, you called yesterday. I said, well, that was yesterday. I mean, I'm calling about today, right? And I'm going to continue to call. Like, I'll talk to you tomorrow. I mean, someone's going to fall out and I'm going to be the guy. And if you do that enough, so eventually they're like, you know, I don't know if they're tired of talking to me, but eventually you can get in the door. I mean, it wasn't as hard as, it's definitely, you got to be on purpose about it. You got to make the calls. But I would definitely say that the way I did it, leveraging some relationships, you know, my only regret, I didn't do it earlier. I wish I would have done it earlier. We just put 100% of our resources into short sale, which ultimately panned out. If I'd have had more, I don't know, staff or resources at that time in terms of time to go after both, I'd have loved to have done that. But definitely it's been a great business, very systematic, very task-driven. So once you get the right systems in your organization in place, you know, in large part, it can kind of run on autopilot. So and you can deliver, you know, great results for your clients.
How many asset managers are you working with currently?
Accounts, we've got 3 or 4 large accounts. So not, you know, you hear these agents that got 40. We don't. We just have some big accounts. So different asset managers, is probably 8 to 10 different asset managers.
And are they all private banks, or are you working with any of the government entities such as HUD, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac?
We're working with some of the government entities and then the large banks.
Do you think now is a good time for an agent to shift and move into REO?
I think that's going to be area specific. If I were in Phoenix and I was an agent, if I was going to go after REO, I would go smaller bank, you know, like someone that can make a local decision. In our place, I mean, it's down, you know, quite a bit that if you didn't have, I never want to say no, because here I came in way late and it really worked out. I personally am not going after more today. That's just not my focus, because I think you're going to get diminishing returns. And I think you could spend better effort to get into something. The accounts that I do have, I mean, I wouldn't see why I wouldn't have them forever. It'll just be a different volume than we're, you know, currently used to or have been used to in the past. But in different parts of the country, like if my marketplace was just heading into distress and I saw short sales were becoming a big, you know, a bigger business, I would definitely go fight for REO, and I definitely would go for the big 3, Fannie, Freddie, HUD. I mean, that's the golden ticket. And then I would go down, I'd take the biggest bank and work my way backwards.
You've mentioned your team quite a bit during this conversation. Let's talk about the team. Can you walk through each of the positions that you have, how many people are in those positions, what those positions are responsible for, and then anything about compensation? For instance, are they paid on a salary or hourly or a bonus or a commission, those kind of things. Can we do that?
Sure. Yeah. I'll start with the person that runs my life, my executive assistant who you spoke with. She is compensated hourly. We don't have benefits per se. Depending on the person, though, I may pay for their medical insurance and I may fund their 401k. But that's not that's a choice, not a requirement. But yeah, so she's purely hourly. Her first role is to manage my life and make sure that I'm where I need to be when I'm supposed to be. She runs my latest thing with my calendar I gave over to her. So she has complete control of my time. And what's so funny is she's been with me now, I think it's her third year, and I've had a number of executive assistants or personal assistants. She's the best one I've had. I mean, she's truly incredible. I mean, she knows how I think. I mean, now there are things that happen. You know, I'll ask her, hey, did you send a thank you card? Oh, I already did it. I took care of that. I mean, it's crazy. It's just done, right? Like today I showed up for this. She has a folder here that tells me, you know, what I'm doing at what time and a cap, you know, a recap of my day, along with the things I talked about her a month ago with what I wanted to prepare for this call. She has it all prepared and it's ready to go. So I sit at my desk, I walk in, I'm ready to go. So she runs everything. And then kind of an overall office manager and make sure things at the office kind of run smooth. The next person I'll go to I'm just kind of going in line of our office here, but the operations manager, she again started as my personal assistant and kept moving, you know, moving up. Today really helps me run the business. But her, aside from that, runs our short sale operation. So anything short sale, that's her world, her domain. She recently hired an assistant for herself and takes care of that. So she is paid a salary plus a bonus, a percentage of the transaction. But she's got a salary, and then her assistant is just salary only. When you come down the line, we've got, so in REO, I did my REO business a little different, I think, than most. I built a certain margin that I wanted to make in the REO business, and I kind of backed into it. So I paid purely a percentage for my REO manager, a percentage of the gross transaction. I'm not saying that that's the best way to do it. It's the way I did it. It worked very, very well for me as I was able to, like I said, lock in a margin. So for me, the REO business has been very, very profitable. I'm trying to walk you through all the admin. So we hit the admin. We also have a virtual assistant that's obviously just paid hourly. And then I'm going to move over to, I guess, one more admin. We have a field, I'm going to call it a field services manager. That's just an hourly position, someone that's hanging signs, taking off lock boxes, driving properties, doing inspections, all those kinds of things. If I move into sales, I've got one person in-house on the REO department that's paid a percentage of the profits on our flips, as well as a percentage of the commission when we buy. And then I've got an agent, like I said, it's another brokerage that will just, if she finds a deal, she knows she can represent me anytime she wants. And then we split the buyer side commission on that. All of my buyers' sales staff are all on a 50-50 split, so they're all commission-based. On the listing department, the people that are banging the phones for me for listings are all paid a salary plus bonus, but the bonus is paid based on listings taken, not listings closed. Because the short sales are, it really doesn't depend on them in large part whether they close. So I didn't feel it was fair to link their compensation to something they had no control over. And so we pay them, they get a very small salary, and if they get 8 listings a month, then they go into bonus. The 7th one is actually worth nothing to them. And the reason why I did that, it's kind of a different compensation, is I had people get to a point like in the month with 6 or 7 listings and they would coast, but that really didn't work for me. So I found if you only pay people if they get 8, you're not going to believe this, a lot of them get 8. So we went that route. So we were able to get that. And then I think that takes you through there. The only other person's me. I'm obviously on a percentage of whatever we make. So that's kind of it. And at the end of the day, I mean, our goal, obviously, I'm with Keller Williams. Our goal is to net 40% of anything we do to the bottom line. And that's the goal of really any real estate business. And that's purely in my real estate business, not counting. I don't count flip profits towards or anything else. But just in the commission in, commission out, regular real estate business, our goal is to net 40% to the bottom line.
Have you been able to achieve that 40% goal?
We have. Yep. And the only other position I can get into is my bookkeeper. It's not an in-house position, but the majority of the work he does do is for me. I could tell you that position is invaluable. We meet He and my operations manager, we meet once a month. And I mean, every time we go line by line over every expense, every piece of income. I mean, we go line by line, and every month we find stuff where we're constantly cutting and trimming and trying to find out how do we do it for less.
Brett, what drives you?
It's changed for me over time. So today I have my little girl just turned one this past weekend, and my son turns four in September. So prior to that, I was driven just to be the best. I've always believed you could go out and I've always wanted to compete, and I was driven for numbers. And definitely when I came to KW, I've always, the top five agents every year get to walk across the stage at the annual convention. And that was always one of my goals. And so we've now done that. For me, it was competing there. Now today I'm more competing for my family, and it's really changes once I had kids, but definitely, I always want to compete and try to be the best in any given field. So I'm highly competitive. I have all the rankings for the different people in our organization here printed. Literally, I'm staring at them in front of my desk right now. I'm looking at it, and every month I'm trying to move up and get to number one. So definitely, that drives me today. Though it's highly family. You know, it's creating a life for them. You know, and making sure that they have everything they want and that I want to provide for them.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation that you had written up a business plan last year and you had to rewrite it. It sounds like you write a business plan every year. Is that true?
I do. I like to take when most people are, you know, typically the fourth quarter, you know, it's when a lot of people are taking off. And essentially, like, my year is really booked right now. I mean, the business we're going to do from now through the end of the year, I really can't make much of an impact on that right now. I mean, there's little things I can do, but essentially the marketing done, the things we've got out there, the sales force in place, we're kind of the end. 2012 is pretty much done for me at this point. But I'll usually September, October, as we're going into the year, I'll kind of finalize what our business plan looks like next year. I mean, obviously I'm working on 2013 now, but we'll finalize what that looks like. We definitely write a plan. This first year where I had to shred it five times and keep changing it because our market just kept changing so much. And I set out to do, you know, I thought this year we'd do 300 to 350 REOs. That's just not going to happen. So I had to revise that and find out how are we getting to our goals if we're going to lose whatever it is, 150 REOs. I still want to sell a certain volume. And so I had to make it up in other areas. So definitely I follow a business plan. I'm a big believer in, I do my goals pretty simply. I do the business goals, and I boil it down to where each department can see how they contribute to the whole. So each manager and each part of that department can see, hey, if I'm a buyer's agent, I'm doing four transactions a month, they understand where they plug into the greater goal. So definitely we unveil that, I guess you could say, it every once a year. I'll sit down and have a vision meeting about where we're going and how we're going to get there. And then it's pretty much, I'd say, monthly, or we've kind of abandoned meetings on a very consistent basis because they were just kind of a waste of time. But I manage, daily I'll talk to the different department leaders. We talk daily about different things that come up. And then I schedule meetings with them probably weekly. But in terms of the whole team getting together constantly, we've kind of went away from that. I mean, we'll do events and fun things, but we don't just pack 15 people in there to hear me talk for an hour.
How often do you review your business plan?
Well, it's taped to my wall, so constantly. I'm always looking at it and seeing how we're doing. And then I run year over year. Like, in fact, I just pulled up my email. I was going to get something for this call, and I looked at a year over year report just came in. So I want to see how are we doing, you know, the first 5 months of this year compared to last year. What does our profit look like? What are our, you know, our volume? How are we doing? So I look at that stuff all the time. I even, like, throughout this entire year with my bookkeeper, when we meet once a month, we go over that stuff, and I'm forced to do it for about 2 hours once a month. I mean, it's the best use of my time. So that business plan is ongoing and constant.
Brett, why are you so successful?
You know, I would tell you that the funny part of that answer is I'm actually not that bright. You know, if you were to give me a purely school academic test, it's not there. I mean, it's hard work. I'm willing to commit to doing whatever it takes. You know, my hours have obviously, I used to just work more hours than anybody because I didn't have that many skills in the real estate business. So I would just work 80 to 100 hours a week while I could get more results. then once we had the family, I had to find a way to somehow get what I was doing in 100 hours into about 40 and not work the weekends anymore. So that came from people. So I would say today the success that we've had has really very little to do with me and much to do with the team that I've assembled. They're incredible. You know, you obviously no human being could sell 667 houses. It's them. So we've got a great team. They understand that together, you know, like I use this analogy the other day with my operations manager. It's her and I together. It's not just two people. Like 1 + 1 does not equal 2. You know, it might be 8. When we come together, you know, it's just the X factor. We can do so much more than we each could alone. And so everyone's really bought into that. I mean, they get the team, they get where it's going, and I really do care about them, I mean, in a big way. I mean, there's nothing that they could ask for me for that was reasonable, I mean, that I wouldn't do. So, you know, they're a big part. We're like a family here. So I'd say that's it. The team would be the key.
How do you keep control of your time?
Well, one, I turn my time over to someone else. That was an easy way to keep control of it. Obviously, Cynthia is kind of my gatekeeper. The biggest thing in my world is meetings. I mean, I could have meetings for 15 hours a day if I would allow it. So any request or something for my time would go to her. If it's something she'll either know, maybe it's an automatic yes or an automatic no. If it's kind of on the edge, she might say, I would need to know the 5 things or whatever you'd like to go over with Brett, and I'll meet with him and to allocate the correct amount of time for that. So at this point, she kind of gets how I want my calendar ran, how I want my day structured. You know, for example, like during the day, like today, she'll call and make sure that every single meeting is going to show up, you know, confirm that they're going to be there. She'll call them 30 minutes ahead of, hey, are you running late? You know, just because you could spend another half your day just waiting on people to show up somewhere. The majority of our meetings, I'd say we always do at my office. I try to almost always meet at my office so I can keep working. And if they're running late, I'm still here working. But I mean, the final thing for me was turning it over. The other thing is my cell phone hardly ever rings. All those calls are routed to the office and handed by admin. I mean, the calls and the people that really need me, it's a couple people a day that actually need to talk to me about something. And it's funny, if you go back 4 years ago when I first hired my first personal assistant, I actually gave her my cell phone and got a blocked number because it rang so many times I couldn't get anything done. And I said, part of me hiring you is you've just got to take all these calls and manage to get it done. So that was kind of a transition. I would say to get control of your time, if you're not at the place for the personal assistant, I would start time blocking where you make calls or return emails and stuff at a certain time. But the biggest way is, as soon as you can hire an assistant and the economics will allow you to do that, I would hire an assistant. I don't care what you pay them, as long as it's, I mean, reasonable, you should be making, I mean, if you don't make 3 or 4 times what you're paying them, you're not doing it right. I could tell you for me, I couldn't live without my assistant. I mean, my life would come entangled in minutes.
Did you mention you have some affiliate businesses? Maybe a mortgage and title company. Is that true?
I have partnerships. So we're a big believer in partnerships. Our partners are title and lending. They've definitely helped. They're like, I treat our vendors like stakeholders in our business. My loan officer is probably one of the top 50 in the country, for example. Brilliant guy, great guy, works hard, has a brilliant business. So our clients benefit from working with him, and we benefit. And so, you know, if we need to, if we work together on marketing and different business marketing type things, we leverage our vendors in that way. Same with title. Our title partner has been so huge for our business. You know, they've helped me grow it. They helped us with REO. They're really just on the cutting edge of what's going on and can get you information. Like, for example, they've got a great relationship with banks. So if you're in a short sale, I need to escalate. We definitely leverage those, but yeah, we treat them like partners, and then they definitely, you know, sometimes help us contribute to marketing and other things.
Do you have an ownership position with those companies?
No ownership in those, nope.
If you were to advise a brand new agent just getting into business, what would you tell them to do first?
If I was brand new, I would go to my office and I would pull up the production of every agent in that office, and I'd find someone that was closing 40 plus deals per year. And I would go to them and say, can I set appointments for you and we somehow split the transaction and you'll do the appointment and I can go and learn. That's exactly what I would do for the first and set up a, you know, say for the first five deals, can I set them for you and we'll split, you know, the revenue. And I could tell you any agent doing, you know, 40 to 60 deals would be happy to do that. And it's a way for you to learn. I just think there's so much to learn as a new agent if you're going on your own. And that's a great way to do it. The second thing I would do, or in tandem, would be I would get with a company that provided, you know, all of the training. There's a bunch of great companies out there, but I'd get with a company that provide all the training and tools that would help you be successful.
Brett, do you think the top agent interviews like the one we're doing now are valuable?
I think they're very valuable. So I could tell you my library of things like this is, to say it's extensive is very mild. I mean, I've got literally hundreds of tapes of things like this, and I subscribe to I don't know how many things just like this. I think it's so valuable because if you're listening today or you're listening, I'll use Russell. When I go to see, like, we're friends now. We go to lunch. We hang out. When he gives a local talk, I still go. And I learn. I mean, if I take one idea away that helps me sell an extra 20, 30 houses a year, well, it's well worth my time commitment to that. So I think the best way to summarize that is the best quote I've ever heard was, the only difference between who we are today and who we are a year from now, you know, are the books we read or the people we meet. And I would translate this into that book, which would be like the learning. The only difference who we are is who we learn from and what we learn from what we read or hear. So I think it's very, very valuable.
Brett, I've gotten to the end of the interview. Is there anything else that you would like to talk about we haven't talked about yet?
If I was to leave people with one thing, would be figure out what you want to do. And I think setting clear goals, you know, without just making it all about, you know, an oversimplifying goal setting. But I think establish what it is you're going to do. And I would pick the number in terms of the real estate business. How many deals are you going to close next year? And it doesn't matter what that number is. If it's 10 deals or if it's 400, what's that number? And I would back into that on a monthly basis of, all right, I want to close whatever 100 deals a year. I'm going to need about 8 a month or whatever, you know, 120 a year. I'm going to need 10 a month. And then how am I going to get 10 closings a month? What does that look like? Is that 5 buyers and 5 sellers? Is it 10, you know, sellers and no buyers? And then what activity am I going to do that's going to plug in to get me those? And I think when you back it down to that simple, that's really what my business plan looks like. I think when you get it in those simple terms that, you know, if you say I'm going to close 120 deals, it sounds like a lot to maybe a lot of people on the call. But if you go, well, it's only 10 a month, that's only, you know, 2.5 a week. Well, I could put a buyer and a seller, you know, 2 buyers and 1 seller a week together. That's not that hard to do. I think when you reduce it to that, it becomes doable, and then you just take action on that. So that would be my parting thought.
Well, Brett, you give sage advice. After a huge setback, you've bounced back and rebuilt your practice based on 4 stable pillars. Your determination, drive, and persistence, combined with your willingness to hammer the phones, guaranteed your success. You use hard data to plan your business, yet you're willing to pivot when the plan is not working. You are a true entrepreneur. Thank you again for being our top agent of the month.
You've been listening to the Mastermind Agent Interview of the Month Club, where top agents, rising agents, team members, and guests from across North America reveal their success secrets, strategies, and systems in up-close and personal interviews. You can find all the club interviews at www.mastermindagent.com.